compare two different ways of representing animals and intimacy. And I'm comparing written and spoken words. And I'm focusing on how people talk about the animals that they regard as kin. So it's the animals that they share their domestic space with. And I'm drawing on two sets of data. I commissioned a mass observation directive, which people responded to by writing about their relationships with animals. And I also conducted 21 in-depth interviews with people about how they relate to the animals that they live with. And I found that in writing about relationships with animals, people produce a really intimate account, an almost confessional account of their relationships with animals. And the intensity of the emotions is what really, really struck me in these accounts. Not in all of them, but in a lot of them. But when you're talking to another person in an interview situation, the reference to emotions is more elliptical. It's not so, it doesn't come out so immediately, and sometimes it doesn't really emerge at all. And so those two different representations of how people relate to the animals they live with is what I want to explore the differences. So I'll just tell you a little bit about how I came to be interested in this. I did some research on families in Swansea. I mean, not that Swansea is particularly relevant, but we weren't focusing on animals, but when we asked people who counted as family, a really quite high proportion of them talked about animals, and they often were a bit hesitant about whether they could do that in the context of a research project that wasn't explicitly about animals, but all the people involved in it were really sensitive to this, and we encouraged them, and that really piqued my interest, and I thought, well, I really want to look at this a bit more, so I decided, and also there's other research in sociology, I'm a sociologist, there's other research that's looking at how animals share intimate spaces and houses, and how important animals are to children, and how children regard animals as significant kin, members of their kinship networks. And so what I did was I thought looking at this idea of kinship across the species barrier, the so-called species barrier, would be a really interesting thing to explore. So as I've said, I commissioned a mass observation directive, and I carried out these interviews. And what I want to do is just compare the difference in the material. So how is intimacy represented in the written accounts that you get from the mass observation directive? Dorothy Sheridan, who was the person in charge of the directives for a long time, the mass observation archive, she makes a distinction between subjective and objective ways of writing in response to the directives. And she says that some accounts reveal, and these are her words, feelings, opinions, and activities of the writer. And I should have gone on. Oh, I should have told you about this first. This was the directive, and it had this was the opening paragraph, but it was about the part played by animals in your life from your childhood until the present day. You may live and work with animals or rarely encounter them. Whatever your circumstances, we're interested in your experience with animals and any stories you can tell us which throw light on the part they play in your life. So it was about this, it was stories, the encouragement to tell stories. And the data that we had, just really briefly, there were 244 responses with a big age range, two-thirds women, one-third men. And I used the mass observation responses to develop the interview schedule with the quantitative interviews. The interviewees were contacted in different ways, and in 10 of the interviews there was more than one person present, and in all the interviews except for one, animals were present. So the animals were materially, physically there in the interviews, and clearly they weren't in the written responses. The mass observation responses were incredibly varied. Some were really brief and some were long, like 20, 30 pages of written script. they can be really intimate and revealing, and that is related to gender. That's what I just started talking about. That Dorothy Sheridan has talked about how that's related to gender, saying that the more subjective accounts, which are like sort of diary entries almost, is much more typical of women, obviously not exclusively, but more typical of women. And she says that the social reportage, like writing a school essay or something a bit more formal, was more typical of men, particularly men over 50, is what she says about it. And what panel members are encouraged to tell stories, and Sheridan talks about it as being like a variant of the autobiographical genre. What I want to try and bring out, I mean, obviously I can only talk about a very small part of what they say, but what I want to bring out is the emotional intensity of these accounts, and also their fragmentary nature. They weren't all fragmentary, but there are some very tantalising fragments that you get from this sort of data. A lot of the accounts, it was really interesting, they wrote their life histories through the different relationships they'd had with animals, starting from their childhood and moving right up to the present day. But they wrote about sharing intimate spaces with animals, bathrooms, bedrooms, and the physical closeness and the embodiment of the relationship that was really important. One of the older correspondents, a 78-year-old woman who was living on her own, wrote about her cat. And she says, "Xanadu was, I suppose, the cat of my life. He was a seal point, disregarding from the first every basket, box, cushion, cardigan I offered as a possible bed. He spent the first night in a box of records at the bottom of the wardrobe. Silly boy. For every night afterwards, he slept behind my knees in whatever bed I chose. It was his place. We even turned over in concert. When it was really hot, he might burrow upwards, and some mornings we ended up nose to nose on the pillow. But his favourite place was behind my knees." So the physical closeness of that relationship is really clear. Sensuality was also written about, which is perhaps something which is more difficult to speak about. And an 80-year-old woman who wrote that she'd never had an interest in animals. She wrote, "The only animal story I can recount involved yours truly sunbathing on Portmere Beach, St. Ives, 45 years ago. I was clad in a tiny strip of clothing, and a small black cat, which was wandering about the sun, jumped unbidden onto my flat belly and licked all the available flesh. I have never forgotten the sexy roughness of the tongue. These days people would say it's like, wow." And lots of correspondents wrote about falling in love with animals, and Carol Smart and Linda Burke have also written about this in relation to horses. And one of them wrote about a Pekingese, and she says, "One of the most intense experiences in my life was with a young Pekingese whom I found one day hiding under a car in the street in West London. He had no collar and seemed lost, so I took him to the police station and they took my details, letting me bring him home until he was claimed. But no one did claim him, so he became mine, and we fell in love with one another. He was enchanting." And what strikes me about that, apart from the falling in love, is that she says that is one of the most intense experiences of her life, which is a bit like what Sarah was talking about with the grief, the visible grief of the death of the dog. It was a dog, wasn't it? Yes. These are fragments. That was a fragment. That was all she really said in her. That was a short account. And you can't pursue them because they're written accounts and they've written them and sent them into the archive. You can't pursue them, like in an interview, to say, "Oh, could you tell me more about that?" But you can't, and it's there, and that's all you've got. And I think one of the things about the written accounts is that it's easier to divulge things that you might not necessarily divulge in a face-to-face interaction. And there are some things that it's difficult to talk about. Something else that is often difficult to talk about is violence in domestic settings. And there are allusions to violence. And this woman spoke about, she said, this was about the time my parents' marriage finally broke up. And I remember feeling heartbroken when it's around this time Skipper was knocked over by a car and killed. When my mother used to beat me, I would go and get in the airing cupboard and cuddle Skipper. So Skipper, her ginger cat, when she was a child, was clearly really important as a comfort. And I think the greater ease of writing about these kinds of difficult emotions or emotions that you feel maybe not quite acceptable. Is because these accounts are anonymous. You're sending them in and they're going into an archive and they're completely anonymous. So in a way you're freed up from the moral ambivalence that there is about relationships, human-animal relationships, human-other animal relationships. And a lot of the accounts, as I said, are really very confessional. But there's no possibility of judgment. There's no possibility of moral judgment because of the anonymity. Now, the interview data are different, quite clearly. They're co-constructed in a conversation between you or the interviewer and the person. There's a possibility of moral judgment in that interaction. You have to sort of work out whether that's going to be part of it. And because of that, I think the ways that human-animal intimacy or the intimacy with that particular animal or those particular animals are presented actually takes a different form. Often responses weren't very direct. It was much more about the animals. I mean, in almost all of them, the animals were there, and the animals often made their presence very, very felt. They were much more about the practical things that they did with the animals, and also it may partly have been affected by the fact that there was more than one person present in 10 of the interviews, so that in the interviews with people on their own, you sometimes got a bit more closer to the emotions, but it's still not anything like the sort of confessional, and the intensity wasn't there. So I just want to give you some examples from the interviews. I took some notes on one of the interviews just to show that the presence of the animals. This is me writing about the interview. I was offered tea in a mug and we sat at the kitchen table for the interview. The door to the yard was in the kitchen. Bailey started off by scratching all the drawers in the corner. Then he barked and did play bows until Mrs. Jones opened the drawer and gave him a handful of tunes. Then he scratched at the door to go out. Then he came in and scratched at another set of drawers. Then he went and got toys. All the time he was doing something and wanting attention and getting it. In and out, chews out of the drawer, games with the toys, demanding to be stroked. So he was a very active presence, and a lot of the animals were. They were, you know, they were walking around on the settee or walking over the coffee table or jumping around on the chair that I was sitting on or whatever. They were very much there. But it takes time to get to feelings about animals, and I think the moral ambivalence is more evident. I mean, one heterosexual couple that I interviewed, they talked about having included the animals in their will, and they said, oh, it's really weird, isn't it? We're really weird. And then another couple also talked about their sleeping arrangements, and they said, we've tried that's your bed, you sleep there, but generally it's under the covers at the bottom of the bed. He's got this thing where now where he'll go under the covers and he'll actually lie full stretch between us. And if I'm on my side, he sleeps round at the side of me lengthways. Yeah, I know it's not. I know a lot of people don't like the thought of dogs being in their bed, but we don't actually mind. So in that, there's a sort of, well, I know that you might not think this is okay, but we don't mind. And I found myself, in response to that and the weirdness of making a will, I found myself saying, no, it's fine, there are lots of people who do that, it's fine, it's okay, to get them to talk more about it. But actually, What that meant was that I didn't explore the embarrassment, and it would have been really interesting to explore the embarrassment. Another way of talking, I interviewed a police dog handler who was spent an hour or so telling me about all the incredibly dangerous situations that he'd been in with his dog and how his dog had saved his life on more than one occasion, and it was very sort of macho stuff. And then he started talking about the dog's ashes, and it was like a sort of rather indirect way of talking about it. He talked about the dog's getting in, i.e. becoming attached to them despite himself almost. And he then spoke about the dog's ashes, and he said, because he has all the dog's ashes, and he says, and do I talk to the ashes? Yes, I do. So if I move him out of that cupboard, I'll tell him I'm moving him because of things people have said to me, of experiences they've had. I didn't want to risk it. One of the women I worked with, she said she'd bought a pet dog home, it couldn't settle, and she spoke to the ashes, moved the ashes around and said, look, I'm not putting you away, I'm just moving you. The dog settled down, it was as if the spirit, or whatever you want to call it. My God, I said. I know, that's getting deep, I know, yeah. And I just sort of said it as a bit of, I'm always like in the back of my head, I always say it tongue in cheek, oh bodge, I'm just moving you now, I'll clear up, don't start causing any trouble. Deep down, I know he's still here. I've got a bit of his fur in a cup here. So, this is a very sort of spiritual connection still with this dog, and it wasn't only one of his dogs that he still had the ashes of. So underneath all the macho stuff was a really deep emotional connection with the dogs that he's got. But it took a lot of time to appear, and even so, he's sort of saying, oh well, I say it tongue in cheek. So there's a distancing still there from it. Relations were always also spoken about in gendered terms. I interviewed a couple who both had guide dogs. She still did and he didn't anymore. And he tried to pin down the difference between his and his wife's relationship with the dogs. And he said, yes, I think, as I say, Nita's relationship with her dog is maternal. That's the model that strikes me she has, whereas with me it's more, as I was saying, a working partnership, master and dog kind of thing. And then he goes on to say, but as I say, the dog was integrated into the family, and I wouldn't say it was part of the family, that's a bit sentimental for me, but it was certainly integrated into the household, and you know, had its place in the household and its respect in the household. It's quite interesting that he talks in terms of it there as well. Because and he did, he talked much more personally about the dogs at other points. But he talked about getting a guide dog in really interesting terms. He talked about it being like a marriage, so for better or worse. He also talked about it in terms of having a child. And he also talked about it in terms of embodiment, that it's an embodied relationship with the dog. That he talked about the dog being an extension of his left arm, so that it was part of him. This is what he said. I used to say, if my dog was taken away, say by accident, you know, I'd had an accident or whatever, and I didn't have a dog to use, I felt as though my left arm had been cut off, because your dog is sort of attached to you all the time, and you feel it's working through your left arm. And so when you don't have the dog at the end of your left arm, particularly when you're outside, it seems a part of you is missing. You know, it's very, very close. And I think that embodiment is really, really important there. That's what he's talking about. I think there are differences between in these accounts, and I've only just been able to sort of brush the surface of it, but the fascination of the mass observation accounts lie in their particularity. They're very autobiographical, they're very confessional, not all of them, as I say. And they're a little bit like a novel. They're literary accounts, and you as the reader can read a lot into it as well. They're a very rich source of data on emotions and intimacy, and it creates a sense that you, the researcher, really know the writer. Interviews are not autobiographical. They were different. They were much more about the here and now. The emotions and intimacy were not spoken of directly. They were alluded to and inferred in the ways that I've tried to show you, but they weren't there. They weren't. It wasn't as intense. And there was much more ambivalence and checking whether it was okay to say things or not. And I think that the other major difference is that the animals were there, and I haven't said very much about that, but they were there so that I was able in the interview situation to not only hear them talking about the relationship with the animal, but to observe the relationship with the animal. The animal was a very real material presence and often made quite a difference to how the interview proceeded.